So we're going to just use this moment before we can really get started to bring our minds to rest, or whatever may be happening. Let our minds come to rest and completely receptive to whatever visual impressions, whatever sound, whatever tactile sensations, whatever thoughts and feelings may arise. Just be totally open and receptive to those within the vast space of awareness. And with a warmth of compassion, like a compassionate acceptance and receptivity. Just feeling what it feels like to be in the present moment. Okay, so now we'll go ahead and do our prayers. let's see, we have it. Okay. All right. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon. This imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And I've forgotten my teacher prayers, so we will simply bring to mind the four Dharmas of Gompopa for, you know, all of us and all beings. May our minds turn toward the Dharma. May the Dharma follow the path. May the path arise as confusion. The path not arise as confusion. This is what happens when we go extemporaneous. May the path cease to arise as confusion. May the path dispel confusion, is the way Gompopa expressed it. And may confusion arise as wisdom. And may all beings in all languages be able to understand the Dharma wherever it is taught. So does everything sound okay now? We have the other computer shut down. It was going to be really nice because you were going to be able to see each other. But anyway, we have the teachings. That's the important thing. And so now we will do, I don't have that. Oh, wait a minute. We have it somewhere, the reminder for. Well, let's just all, never mind. We don't have them handy at this moment, including me. But let's just engender aspiration bodhicitta, that in order to free all, I will attain awakening in order to free all beings. His numbers fill the extent of space. And in order to do that, I will study, contemplate, and meditate as we are doing now. And this is winging it. But I do have the text with me, so from now on we should be good. Okay, and I also have a lovely audiovisual aid. I don't remember having this particular one the last time I was here, but I might have just forgotten. Patrick and Marilyn have this amazing, beautiful wheel of life with Yama at the top holding it to the mouth of death. And all the six realms, you can see like the middle part with the three poisons chasing each other around and the, you know, karma going up and the karma going down. That's this inner circle. And then the six realms are there. And then the 12 links all around the edge. And this is very old. I don't see a date on it, but Marilyn was just explaining to me that this is very old. It was in the Utney Reader, if anybody remembers that magazine, like in the 80s and 90s, I think. It was like a two-page spread. You can see it's two pages actually taped together. And on the back, it has like the explanation of the whole thing. So it's quite lovely. Yeah, it's a really nice thing to have. So that's what we are studying today. We could be wrapping it up. We'll see how the time goes. But we're very close to the end. So my book is here. So we are in Trungpa Rinpoche's book. In my trusty Kindle, location 474. Does not help anyone at all, but what page is it on of the printout, the PDF?
The PDF is page 29.
Okay,
Independence of the
Right. Yeah. We're Independence in the Sutras. It's at the end of chapter 3, towards the end of chapter 3, Independence of the Sutras. Page 29?
Of the PDF.
So somewhere in there. I'm sure everybody can find it in their version. Okay, same for the book, says Patrick. All right, so I'm not going to do any review today because it's really in here and we've all heard it and studied it up to this time. So just to continue with Trungpa Rinpoche, what comes out of the study of interdependence, which is what this is the understanding that all relative things, that's everything we experience in our life through our six senses, all relative things only appear because all the things we experience are dependent on each other. What we discover in the teachings on interdependence is that phenomena depend upon each other. One thing depends upon other things for its relative existence. We come across this fact in the Mahamudra teachings, even though here we're talking about the Sutra teachings. When we begin looking for the essential nature of the mind, that's how we overcome ignorance. The first link is by looking for the essential nature of the mind, looking for the way that we really exist and the way that everything really exists. This is addressing the first link, without which none of the other links unfold. There is no interdependence. So when we begin looking for the essential nature of the mind, we do not find any solid nature of mind. So he's helping us cut right through ignorance. You know, he's describing to us a little bit about the nature of mind, the way things really exist, ultimate reality. We do not find any solid nature of mind. Rather, we find emptiness devoid of any inherent nature. This emptiness is mind's essential nature. Even though we discover that emptiness, at the same time we are aware that there is an unbroken stream of mental manifestation. So it's not like avoid emptiness. It's not nothing there. It's like everything there. It's just you can't pin it down in any particular way as existing in any particular fixed permanent way. So even though we discover that emptiness, at the same time we are aware that there is an unbroken stream of mental manifestation. The emptiness we find in our mind is not a mere nothingness because our mind is continually changing. The manifestation of mind, that is, our unbroken stream of awareness, thoughts, and feelings, has no recognizable essence. On the conventional level, also known as the relative level, there is a continuous unbroken interplay of interdependence where one thing creates another. So it's on the relative level that interdependence manifests. Things depend upon each other. This is how reality is presented in the sutras. From an ultimate point of view, however, there is no one essence to be found, and relatively everything has its existence through the play of interdependence. To show how one thing depends upon another for its nature, we can look at two sticks of incense, one of which is 2 inches long and one of which is 4 inches long. So we can imagine those two sticks of incense since we don't have them in front of us. I'll bet he had some. The 2-inch stick is the short one, while the 4-inch stick is the long one. However, when we take away the 2-inch stick and put the 4-inch stick next to a 6-inch stick, we see that now the 4-inch stick is the short one and the 6-inch stick is the long one. We can see that short and long are not inherent qualities of the stick, but are simply qualities that rely on the object's interdependence on the other objects. We would all agree that the 2-inch one is short and the 4-inch one is long, but that the 4-inch stick is short compared with the 6-inch stick. We see that things depend upon each other for definition of their qualities. And you can apply this to everything. He's going to explain that a bit, but really you can apply this to every single judgment that comes into your mind about anything. That judgment, the way it appears to you, depends on context. It's not true ultimately. Nothing that we think is ultimately true. So he says there are many relative values like this, like the short and long. Take, for example, good and bad. Some things are good compared to others and vice versa. The same is true for beautiful and ugly, here and there, self and other. In all cases, the value assigned to something is only a relative value that depends upon other things for its meaning. So something is only beautiful because in one set of relative values, it is more beautiful than some other things. But when compared to something else, it may be ugly. The point is that nothing is beautiful, nothing is long, nothing is bad in itself. They are beautiful, long, or bad in a relative sense. On a conventional level, things have a particular value. But from an ultimate point of view, we cannot say that this thing is once and forever ugly or long, or that is once and forever over there and not over here. Like it's over there now, but if you move to that spot, then it's here. And where you were before is over there. And this sounds really simplistic, but you really can apply it to anything. Like the beauty of it is not to understand that this stick of incense is only short compared to that stick of incense. It's that this thing that this person did is only bad in relation to a lot. It looks bad to you in relation to a lot of things. Or you know, my working definition of emptiness, which I've shared many times, that no situation is limited to being the way that I'm perceiving it. The way I perceive it depends on many, many interrelated factors. So you cannot make an absolute judgment about anything in relative reality. That is my take on this material. So by examining such logical arguments, says Chöngyi Rinpoche, we can examine things in a gross way to get some understanding of the relative interplay and the ultimate emptiness of phenomena. Therefore, in the sutra method of teaching, emptiness is presented by way of this logical reasoning. So this is in Majjhimaka, in the, you know, the sort of the sutric logical approach to understanding emptiness. It's done through this kind of reasoning. And it really goes in, right? Like if Chöngyi Rinpoche were to hold up those two sticks of incense, you would really get like there is no short and there is no long. There is no absolute value to anything. So the next section, Interdependence and Mahamudra, is a different approach to understanding emptiness and interdependence. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I'm going to unmute Lama Jinzong. Other people here will not be able to hear you, so I will relay your comment as best I can.
This has to do with it's probably semantics, but page 29 at the bottom. Are you there?
Yes, I actually just unplugged my headphones so people could hear you directly. Okay. So I'm turning my volume and go ahead.
So it might be fine with you not using headphones, to tell you the truth. There's no weird sound coming in, but whatever. Okay. Just one question. We're on the bottom of 29 where it says, things depend upon each other. This is how reality is presented in the sutras. From an ultimate point of view, however, there is no one essence to be found. And relatively everything has its existence through the play of interdependence. I just found that sentence a little funny because it says from the ultimate point of view, however, in my understanding that it should be that, you know, they're talking, there's no one essence, meaning that within each phenomena from its own side doesn't exist, because ultimately, isn't it true that from the ultimate point of view, all phenomena have in fact the same essence, that of being awareness, clarity, you know, emptiness combined. So that's why I had a little funky moment there.
I can't really answer that. It gets very complicated because mind is also said to have no essence. Like if you read the Mahamudra aspiration prayer,
right?
Mind itself has no essence. It's like hollow bamboo. So I don't know how those two things fit together exactly. Like in the conventional sense, we say that mind has the essence, you know, it's empty. Its essence is empty. Its nature is, you know, clarity and so forth.
I guess, yeah, that it would make sense to me is that, you know, everything has the same essence in the sense if you want no one, you know all, but it's just where it says there is no one essence. I guess I got funked up in that moment, but I'll just...
We're not going to try to parse that too much. I think it's a really good question and a good object of complication.
And I'll do as Lama Norla Rinpoche...
For all of us.
And I'll do what Lama Norla Rinpoche said, and if there's anything that, you know, confuses you, just move on, let it go.
Yes, exactly. But it's good to bring it up. It's good to let that confusion be there and be acknowledged. Mark is going to say something. I'm going to just leave the headphones off for the moment, even though I look like I'm wearing them. Okay, these are fake headphones.
For any kind of instructional or, you know, orientation wise, is there interdependence and interrelation?
He's asking, is there any difference between interdependence and interrelation? I I'm probably not going to try to parse that out because we have limited time, but I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't worry about it for now, but as you run across those terms, you could pay attention and report back if you find a difference, and I will pay attention too. Well, both of those terms in here, I don't remember.
Yeah, you just said them together.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We're gonna take them as meaning the same thing for practical purposes, and if we find out differently, then we will adjust our understanding, and that is the Dharma path. Okay, so how, John, the reason that you asked me to use the headphones was there was a noise in the recording before?
Yeah, so they wouldn't interfere with each other.
Okay, so I could just, so we could let go of the headphones then, as Lama Jinzong suggested. Okay, well, so all of our plans went awry for what would make this session work best, and that's how we learn. Okay, back to the reading glasses. I can see the computer screen with the reading glasses. All of you cyber people, totally sharp. People who are here, like, are a little fuzzy. And vice versa with the other glasses. So anybody else have any comment or question? And Lama Jinzong, I'm going to keep you on mute because there is a little bit of rustly noise from there, but please unmute yourself or just let me know anytime you have anything to add to the discussion. Anybody else? Then we will look. So we have an idea of the sutric approach to emptiness, which is the logical approach here. That's how it's being explained. And now, how do we approach interdependence in Mahamudra? In Mahamudra practice, we approach the same topic slightly differently through meditation. In this way, we come to appreciate that on a relative level, our mind's thoughts, sensory experiences, and appearances come and go through a play of interdependence. We learn to look directly into the nature of what is taking place in the mind. We find that nothing has a nature we can ever grasp. No ultimate lasting essence, as we have discovered through the teachings on interdependent origination. All things have their relative existence, but ultimately nothing has true existence, like independent, lasting, etc. existence at all. So to understand the two aspects of truth, what is relatively true and what is ultimately true, is profoundly important. So we go at it through logic in the sutra method, and we go at it through direct experience, just looking at the mind in Mahamudra. And our tradition is a combination of those two things, because Gampopa brought those two streams together, the monastic tradition that comes out of the Majjhimaka logical approach, and the direct experience tradition, the Mahamudra tradition that came down through Marpa and Milarepa. So any questions before we go on to chapter 5, which is the last chapter? Yes, Marilyn.
It's not exactly a question. It's just the statement that I wouldn't have understood any of what you just said in either the sutra or the Mahamudra maybe 4 years ago. So after all that time in the Dharma, I still wouldn't have, I would have understood it.
Yeah. So sticking with your Dharma study, contemplation, and practice pays off. Did everybody hear what she said, that 4 years ago she wouldn't have understood this? And now she does. So that's the thing. Like, 4 years ago it would have gone like over her head, but she stuck with it. And now it doesn't go over her head. So let that be true for all of us, of the entire Dharma. May that be true. All right, anybody else? All right, then we shall plunge ahead to Chapter 5, the 12 links applied to one's action. Up to now, we have studied the 12 links of interdependence in the context of long-term effect, in relation to past lives that influence this life, the second link, and how this life is shaping the future. We can also present the 12 links in terms of effects over a short period of time by applying the 12 links to one particular action. We can do this by taking one example given in the scriptures, which is the example of killing. And when he says the example of killing is given in the scriptures, it means like to understand how the karma of that works, and that it's not, you know, it's not like instruction manual or anything like that for killing. It's like, don't do this, and this is why. And I wanted to say, like, this is really important point here, that this is not like an unfolding over a period of time where every link is separate. This is, you know, it's starting to make sense to me, that thing that Kala Rinpoche said that we talked about in the very first class on the 12 links, that it's not really a sequence. They all have to be present for an action or an experience to take place. Well, we're going to see that in the act of killing, because really everything is there at the same time. I mean, if you were to kill someone, it would probably be a very quick thing. I mean, it could be premeditated, but the actual act of killing would take place, hopefully, I guess, very quickly. and we're going to see that. Like, this is not like a slow unfolding where every link is distinct. And so I took it upon myself to make a similar analysis of the act of, like, eating ice cream. And I'll share that with you afterwards, and we'll see. I did that because this didn't totally make sense to me. I had to read this a few times and go, oh, it's all happening at one time. He's not presenting it quite the same way. So anyway, without further ado, number one, first link. So it's all the 12 links applied to the act of killing. Number one, first link, ignorance. We see that someone kills because of ignorance, not realizing what a bad thing it is or the karmic results that will come from him doing it. So the cause of killing is ignorance. Generally, ignorance is the very nature of the action and its consequences, and sets the beginning for the other links to happen. Second link comes into play, karmic creation or karmic impulse. If someone kills a person because of ignorance, then the actual act of killing is the second link, karmic creation. And so I wrote myself a note, it's like the beginning of the action. Like, you know, it understood in, like, when we apply the 12 links to one life, to the next life, karmic, at the link of karmic impulse or karmic creation, nothing's really happening yet. But here he's saying it is the act of killing. And I think what's meant here is, like, it's the beginning of the act, because the actual act of killing takes place over all the subsequent links. So if someone kills a person because of ignorance, then the actual act of killing is the second link, karmic creation. That act does not take place all by itself. Various factors accompany it. So third link, consciousness. The third link is the stream of consciousness of the killer, like who that person is, what's going through that person's mind at the time. That is the motivation for killing, the strength of feeling, the vision of the whole act, and how his or her consciousness is imprinted by the act. So that is present also throughout the act of killing. Next one, link four, name and form. The consciousness and the act of killing are accompanied by the fourth link. So the five aggregates, like what goes into making us who we are in this life. The five aggregates of form, feeling, cognition, mental events, and consciousness all take part in the action. So they're all present throughout the act of killing. Number five, the six perceptual entrances are sense faculties. The six sense faculties also play their part because during the act of killing, there is seeing, hearing, and the general play of the sense consciousnesses. Sixth link, contact. In this particular example, the contact takes place when the person is struck with the weapon and the deed is done. So contact is like the knife goes in or whatever. Seventh link, feeling. The seventh link is the feeling in the mind of the killer at the time of the act of killing, whether he or she feels great suffering or pleasure in doing the act. So it's again, it's that simple, pleasant or unpleasant. It's very pleasant to kill someone, or it is very unpleasant to kill someone, or it's kind of neutral to kill someone. That whole, you know, rudimentary reactivity is present during the act. Then we get into the complexities of grasping, link eight. This link is the particular feeling of satisfaction or aversion in carrying out the action. Number nine is the one that we call, craving, number eight. Number nine is what we call grasping. This link is the continuing process of this act of killing. The killer does not stop halfway through, but carries the act out to the end. And then link 10, becoming. This is like, we understand this to be where the action is complete. The 10th link covers the whole action. That is, once the action is being done, then the killer has created the karma, which produces a result. So I think that's the completion of that. So karmic creation, link two, was the beginning of the act. It brought all of the other links into play with it. And then in becoming, the deed is completely done. And then, so that leads to the consequences. Link 11, birth. Birth applies to that particular life and the consequences to the killer in the future. And then 12, aging and death. Aging and death apply to both the end of that life and also to the end of the particular action. Any questions on that? I find it's a bit complex to put all that together, but it's helpful. Anybody have any questions or comments on it before we look at the final bit of the chapter?
I do.
John does, and he's going to come and... Would you like to be on the screen?
No, just let anybody who speaks, anyone who has a question from here,
me and John,
get in it. Is the thought of the act, would that be linked to form?
It seems like it. I mean, I think it's there all the way through, you know, but I think the initiation of it is, it comes out of ignorance, but sort of the whole thing begins with karmic creation. And as we've learned in, I think it's the Gunpo class, there's the thought, an action consists of both the thought and the physical carrying out of the act, physical or verbal carrying out of the act. So I think karmic creation is, I think it's hard to break it down. You can't really break down the act of killing into clean frames. But I think the thought is there coming out of ignorance. You'd have to have the thought before you carry out the action. So thank you for that question, which clarifies the sequence. Okay, Andy and then Patrick.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to.
Can I? No.
Well, would you rather I be up there?
Okay. Oh, yeah, if you can come up here, if it's okay for you to come up here, then people will be able to.
Here.
Yeah, come up to the chair, and then people can see who's asking the question or making the comment, which I think is really good, John. Thank you. Okay. No, it's okay. We're very relaxed here. This is like we're maintaining a relaxed meditative state. Whatever happens is good.
Okay. So
this is Andy.
Hi, everybody. My question is about on the consequences and how, and when we talk about it, that goes into the karma. So, but then we have our actual in front of us consequences where the person goes to jail because he got caught.
Right.
So I'm not sure how to think about that. I mean, where is it? Is it at a different place on the wheel?
So you're saying that, like, if somebody kills somebody and they get caught, they go to jail, and that's the consequence. So maybe, so why would there be also a karmic consequence if they've paid off the consequence by going to jail? Is that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, is the if there were no consequences, would the karmic make up for it? If there were no,
yeah,
actual consequences.
That's how I understand it. I mean, I think that it's not totally paid off by going to jail. It might be.
Good.
It might be. But if you don't get caught, like, it's actually considered better to pay off immediately if you can. It's considered that's better because karma, if you read The Torch of Certainty, if you read teachings specifically on karma, the weight of karma, like the magnitude of the effect, increases the more time passes. So if you don't get caught, if you don't have a way to pay it off in the short term, then the long term is going to be worse.
Okay.
That's sort of how it appears to me.
That makes sense to me.
Looks like Lama Jinsung might have
a... how to make it fit.
Stay here because Lama Jinsung has something to say on this.
Okay.
Because even though you go to jail, it doesn't mean necessarily that you've changed your mind or that you are, through the act of going to jail, you've been rehabilitated. So that, you know, that's another thing which I begin to say that, you know, because it's confusing to me that it says aging and death is the end of that particular action. But so to me, it's like birth and aging and death is kind of the same thing because it's the ripening of karma. And that in the sense that the end of a particular action is that, I don't really know what that means because if children had said that the action is completely done at 10, what it means aging and death at 12. But regardless, I think the idea also is like you're saying, even though you've gone to jail, it doesn't mean that that habitual tendency towards anger or whatever is the motivation for killing has in any way been lessened. And that then carries on into the karmic imprints of the next life. So that's how I would think of it.
Thank you. That makes good sense. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you, Andy.
Now I'll go back to my
okay,
own
seat. Patrick, you had something?
God, you look awful.
Come on up. Come on up, Patrick.
Come on down.
Yeah, come on down. You're in the hot seat.
Hello. this reminds me of a saying that I heard once that was, time is nature's way of keeping everything from happening at once. What are the implications for time in this mix of things?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure like what that question would necessarily mean. Lama Jinsung, she might have something to say. Do you?
I could try something, which is, am I unmuted?
You're unmuted, yeah.
I mean, time itself is relative. So what does that mean? You know, I mean, so I don't remember, I can't think of what you're saying, Patrick, in terms of, you'd have to repeat your comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we have
time is
nature's way of keeping everything from happening at once.
Well, that's, I would imagine, because time has the construct of there being a past, a present, and a future, and that keeping it, that's how we can say that everything stop, you know, doesn't happen at once, because we conceive of everything as having a past, a present, and a future. Whereas if you think, I mean, I don't know who said nature has a way. That's just another concept that someone created, that nature has a way. But, you know, if time itself is relative and doesn't actually truly exist, then there's that whole confusion that would arise about there being no such thing as past, present, future. And there's that false notion that might everything happen simultaneously. But we do know that there is a sense of there being separate. It, you know, I guess that's the point, is how would we respond relatively if there was no sense of past, present, and future? We'd be, you know, that everything's happening all at once. I can't even begin to conceptually, you know, go there. So that's what comes to mind.
Okay, that's the best we can do, considering that we've only got 15 minutes left to... Yeah, because that's like a deep question, sure. And it's not... I mean, I'm not seeing the exact relationship to this, which is probably what you're asking, what's the exact relationship to the 12 links,
like,
but
cause and effect seems like it has a
linear time. Yeah, it seems that way. That's based on time, but it's all within, as Lama Jinsung pointed out, this is all within relative reality. Mm-hmm. Time is also within relative reality. Ultimately, time doesn't exist.
Okay.
And everything does happen all at once, except that nothing happens.
Well, appearances arise, but it's not that nothing happens.
No, it is that nothing happens. That's a quote from Kenpo Siltram Jungso.
Well, nothing fair enough.
It ever happens. In ultimate reality, nothing happens. It's all happening in relative reality. It's only in relative reality that things happen. They're visible from, you know, ultimate reality, I guess. They're all one thing. You can't separate them out, but that's a valid Dharma quote.
Wow.
Okay. Anything further on that?
No.
Okay. Sorry, I could not come up with a better answer, but thank you, Lama Jinsung. Okay. Anybody else have any questions?
I have one.
Okay, Mark, you got to come in the hot seat.
I'll come in the hot seat.
Mark, who is never seen on video. Well, yeah, I know. You introduced yourself last time I was here. So.
Yeah, so I have some, I have a confusion about the contact part of this example.
Okay, yeah.
Because the way I was looking at it was that there's, you know, the building of the consciousness, and then there's a contact with the mm-hmm. with the real
right.
world. And the way this is described is that when the contact happens, the murder is already done.
Yeah. Well, right? Yeah, the contact is like the knife goes in. Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought there would be more after the contact of the senses with reality or mm-hmm. whatever, the real world, then there would be more of there's something else going on after that. So the murder would be kind of later on in the sequence.
Oh. Yeah, I think there might be different ways to parse it within the 12 links. I'm not sure. And I'm going to share my example of ice cream, too, where I parse it a little differently. But Trungpa Rinpoche is the one who knows. So we're just trying to get to that same understanding by whatever means we can.
Yeah.
So it's a good question. But I have a feeling that there might be different ways to relate the 12 links to the act of killing than this one. Because, again, it's all relative. You know, it's all context-based and many different ways to look at it. Okay, anybody else before we go to ice cream? Okay, virtual ice cream, sorry.
I think Joanne had.
Oh, sorry, Joanne. I'm just going to put my other glasses back on. Joanne, I'm unmuting you now.
I'm kind of backtracking to the lady that presented her question about karma. And I kind of keyed in on your comment about the weight of the karma. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put myself in the new NYC. I'm in a penal system, all right? I would like to see that there is a bodhisattva chaplain out there that perhaps can present the interventions to, I would say, spare this inmate mm-hmm. or give that inmate an opportunity to apply the four powers and the opportunity to express deep regret, not to release him into society, but to extend, give him that I guess that peace of mind, that it's not beyond.
Yeah. Well, you're bringing in a good piece of it that we have not addressed, and not particularly addressed in the book, I think, that you can mitigate karma. Like, it's not like a sentence that will never go away until you pay the full-blown thing off. It's that you can chip away at it by doing practice. You know, any Dharma practice counts, particularly the four powers, which you're referring to. If you realize that you've done something negative, hopefully it's not killing someone. But if you've done something negative, you first acknowledge it, recognize and acknowledge it. I did that. You resolve never to do it again. You call upon the sources of refuge. You know, you remember that you have refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that's behind you on this. And then you remediate it however you can through practice. Or I tend to also think that you could remediate it, if you can remediate it directly by apologizing even, you know, whatever you could do to remediate it with the person. If you can't, then you have the remediation of Dharma practice. So we have methods like Dorje Sempa, the recitation of Dorje Sempa, to actually purify karma. And I just want to say also that in New York City, Rikers Island has a Buddhist chaplain, a Kagyu Buddhist chaplain who's a student of Jalsap Rinpoche, Justin Buidos. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. And I'm sure he does work with inmates that way as much as possible.
Thank you, Lama.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. I'm going to unmute Fanny.
Okay. Yeah, and let's not forget Victoria, who has been working with inmates for years, being a pen pal, if you will, like with you on the path.
Yeah, Pema Chodron does that too. She's corresponded with inmates for years. And we have a Sangha member in Richmond. We've had different ones at different times, but we have a Sangha member in Richmond who's working with people in the federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. So yeah, that's good. Thank you. All right, I'm going to go on now, if I can, to ice cream. And then we'll finish the chapter. And then if we have a few minutes left, we can have some more discussion. All right, so my example of ice cream, I wrote it down so that I would remember it. Now I have to find the page.
That's okay.
So mine doesn't correspond exactly to Trungpa Rinpoche, but was the best that I could come up with comparing to the 12 links. So first link, ignorance, like just specifically with regard to ice cream or whatever you want to substitute for ice cream. Not remembering the suffering that has happened to you in the past when you have overindulged in ice cream. Not remembering that suffering leads to thinking that this time is the exception. Being ignorant of the karmic result, which is that you will suffer if you overindulge. We're not talking about like a little dainty serving of ice cream, which we certainly enjoy. We're talking about a full-blown ice cream addiction here. I might have to mute Lavendon. Let me unmute everybody and we can have a good laugh together. All right, so from that ignorance, and ignorance, that's what ignorance is. It's not like not knowing something, it is forgetting something. It's like not paying attention to what you know. It's like, in a sense, it's almost like knowing unawareness. Like, yes, I forgot that this always leads to a bad result, so I'm gonna do it again. So the karmic impulse is the habitual pattern of reacting to the idea of ice cream with desire. You have that pattern every time you see ice cream or see a reference to ice cream, you really got to have some ice cream. If you see it, you will want it. So that's karmic impulse. Third, and that comes from the past. 3, 4, and 5 I lumped together. That's consciousness, name, and form, and sensory faculties, because that is who we are. Like, that's the picture of who we are in this life. So a person, you are a person who reacts to ice cream. Wait a minute. Who you are in this life is a person who reacts to ice cream. So 3 and 4, consciousness and name and form, are the 5 skandhas. It's up through the senses that will see, smell, and taste ice cream when it's encountered and will feel hunger or craving for that ice cream. So number 6, we're up to number 6, where it actually starts to happen. This is where it starts to happen. So far, we're just who we are. We're a person who loves ice cream. 6 contact, we pass the ice cream store, the Ben and Jerry's, or we see an ad for ice cream, or we're in the grocery store and we just happen to pass the ice cream in the frozen food aisle. And that's contact, like your eye makes contact with the ice cream. And then the feeling comes in number 7, the feeling, like the prospect of ice cream feels very pleasant to you. And you know, you could do this backwards if you have an aversion to ice cream. Same thing, you pass it in the aisle and you, oh no, no ice cream. That's the feeling of ice cream being unpleasant, and somebody could have that. So we could, you know, remember that this could all apply to an aversion as well as a craving. So right now we're just at pleasant, unpleasant, right? Oh, it would be very pleasant to have some ice cream. You are not in trouble yet. This is okay. It's okay to feel very warm feelings towards ice cream and to feel like you would really like to have some ice cream. Totally not in trouble, because you can sit with that feeling and not act on it. But right. Here comes link number 8, craving. You want that pleasure. You know how good it would feel to eat the ice cream, and you want to do it. You really want to do it. So by indulging that thought, by not going, that thought is just an empty manifestation of mind's nature, by indulging in it and turning it into a chain and really thinking about it, you move on to the next link, which is grasping, number 9, and you decide you must have the ice cream. And you plan how you're going to get the ice cream. You open the freezer case, put your hand in, you decide which flavor you want. I hope nobody here is really addicted to ice cream, because I feel very contrite if I'm like inflaming a desire for ice cream in anyone. But you pull out your favorite flavor, you put it in your cart, and you go, you wheel it to the checkout. You're still not really in trouble. You could stop here. You could absolutely stop here. You could suddenly collect yourself and go, you know what? I remember now what happens when I eat like a pint or a quart of ice cream, and you could wheel it back. You could still wheel it back. There is no karmic consequence yet, but you don't. So here comes link number 10. You secure and eat the ice cream. You pay for it. You put it in your car. You take it home. You open it up. You turn on the TV. You open the ice cream. You get the spoon. Like, there's all these moments when you could intervene. So many separate actions and thoughts have to go into actually making that ice cream happen. So you eat the ice cream. That's number 10. So then 11 and 12 is the effects of the ice cream. Like, it's not the dainty serving, because we don't get into trouble with that. If we're not too attached to ice cream, we can enjoy ice cream. It's fine. But we can't eat the dainty serving. We next have to have the second dainty serving, and then it's like the whole pint is gone. And then I remember I have an old pint still in the freezer. And so that's where the suffering comes into it. And the whole thing unfolds. You know, the next morning you get on the scales and it's like, oh no, you know, I've just put on 3 pounds, and you feel queasy and all of the things, the bad things that happen. And the worst of it is you've reinforced that karmic tendency. So the next time you pass ice cream, it's going to be even harder not to indulge the whole thing. And so after the consequences unfold in steps 11 and 12, we're back to link one, ignorance. Like, we forget again, time passes. Maybe we remember, like, the next 2 times we're at the grocery store, I was like, oh my God, I felt horrible the last time I went down the ice cream aisle, so I'm not even gonna go down the aisle. But then one day you're just feeling a little stressed, a little depressed, like you could use a little pick-me-up. So you go down, fearlessly go down the ice cream aisle, and the whole thing unfolds again. So that's my ice cream, you know, story of the 12 links. So we just have a few minutes left. Does anybody have any comments or questions? I'm hoping we can just read this last bit. But if anybody has anything they want to say before we go on to the last bit. Okay. Let me make my Kindle work here. This is my trusty Kindle. So now we are down to the last section of the chapter, the 3 groups of the 12 links. And I have such a vivid memory of the first time Lama Norla Rinpoche taught this, like when I was there, it was probably 1980. And like nobody, we didn't have any translators. But like Yeshe Jamsa was there, and Drupton was there, and Supa was there, Elizabeth Callahan, they were all there. And nobody could understand what he was talking about and how you group these links. And finally, after much discussion amongst ourselves, you know, with Lama Norla Rinpoche there, you know, and encouraging us to try to figure it out, we finally figured out that some of them were involved with karma, and some of them were involved with something else, and some of them were involved with suffering. But it took a long time because we didn't have a way to really understand what he was saying. It's very complex, actually. So to Trungpa Rinpoche, though, as I'm still seeing Lama Norla Rinpoche in my mind, like teaching this at Kagyu Zamlin Hunchab in New York City, the 12 links of interdependence we have been studying can be placed in 3 groups, showing that they have 3 types of character, so 3 distinct ways of grouping all of these 12 links. Certain groups of them have something in common. So the first one is defilement. The 3 links of ignorance, which is link one, I wish that the people who called it by the regular names, craving, link 8, and grasping, link 9. So ignorance, craving, and grasping are part of defiled mind and therefore are connected to the obscuring emotions. So when it says defilement, it means that these are directly related to the obscuring emotions or the emotional defilements of desire, anger, jealousy, and so forth, links 1, 8, and 9. The 3 main obscuring emotions are attachment and aversion, links 8 and 9, and ignorance, link 1. Okay, so that's pretty easy. That last sentence ties it all up. Like, each of these 3 links corresponds to 1 of the obscuring emotions or emotional defilements. The second group is action. The word karma literally means action, which is connected to link 2, karmic impulse, and link 10, becoming. Those are where it's about an actual action taking place. With karmic creation, it's like the impulse that's going to unfold as the whole cycle and culminate in link 10, where we actually carry out the action. And then the third one is all the third group relates to suffering. The remaining group is suffering, which is connected to links 3, consciousness, 4, name and form, 5, perceptual entrances or sensory perceptions, 11, birth, and 12, aging and death. And you could contemplate this. We don't have time to like go into detail about it, although if anybody has a specific question, we can try to address that. But just to know, I think the first two are easy to understand, that some links relate to emotional defilements and some relate to actual action. Third one's a little harder. How do they relate to suffering, consciousness, name and form, sensory perceptions? Birth and aging and death are obvious, but we're just going to leave it at that for the purposes of the class and read this last section. Understanding how things happen on the conventional level of perception is very important. It encourages us. So this is the wrap up, like why we did this. Why did we study this? Understanding how things happen on the conventional level of perception is very important. It encourages us to develop good conduct of body and speech. It is the understanding of how things happen on the conventional level that gives rise to great love and compassion for others. You see how these 12 links unfold for yourself and how inexorable they are. And so when somebody else messes up, knowing how hard it is, you could actually have sympathy for them instead of just coming down on them like a hammer, which is what we tend to do. So you could develop love and compassion based on understanding how this unfolds. Love in wishing others to be happy and compassion in wishing others to be free of relative suffering. From that point of view, the ultimate level is to understand how things take place on the conventional level, and it is most important. And that's where he leaves us. That's it. So it was important to understand this. Understanding, as he said at the beginning of the book, like there's two branches of Buddha Dharma. One is to understand ultimate reality, and that's what we're aiming for. That's what we don't understand. That's what we don't have experience with. We're confused in samsara because we don't understand how things are ultimately. But in order to understand the way that things exist ultimately, we have to begin by understanding how things unfold and happen conventionally, which is how things are interdependent. And so he says, from that point of view, the ultimate level is to understand how things take place on the conventional level, and it is most important. I don't know if he means it is the most important thing or it is just very, very important. It is most important to understand that, but it is very important. He's saying it's very important to understand conventional or relative reality, the 12 links, how we experience things, how we create our own experience, our own reality, by going through these 12 links on every possible level of our life. So it is now almost 1 o'clock. We might have 1 or 2 minutes if anybody has a question or a comment. Where do we go from here?
I'm gonna quick.
Yes, John, come on over into the hot seat.
Yeah, really quick. Can you explain again? Well, you gave us the 3 categories now. Can you tell me what the name would be of each of the 3 categories? I mean, do they have names?
That he went through?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard breakdown of it, but I forgot.
Yeah, if you hadn't been up here sort of helping out, you would have seen that each one has a heading. Defilement is the first one.
Okay.
Action is the second one. And suffering is the third one.
Okay, that's what I was unclear.
And they're explained, yeah. Because you weren't looking at a text because you were up here.
Thank you.
All right, anybody else? Here or there? Lama Jinzang, I am unmuting you.
When it says the conventional ultimate aspect, do you not have a first paragraph that talks about in the sutra tradition? Because we have the second paragraph. Yeah, you didn't read that. That's why.
I did read that. I thought I read that.
No, you went right to understanding how things happen. That's why I got confused.
Okay. Sorry about that if I didn't.
No, it's okay. I just didn't know if the book was different somehow.
Yeah, you're right. I guess I didn't read that. I must have hit my little button. Shall I read that very quickly? Okay. In the sutra, so this is right under the conventional ultimate aspect, right under those 3 categories. In the sutra tradition, the 12 links are more closely related to the conventional truth than the ultimate truth. because the conventional level deals with how most persons actually experience the world. One understands that a flower comes from a seed, and this is the truth about the relative process of manifestation. This is the truth on a relative level. The ultimate truth in this system is presented as a remedy to ignorance and the suffering created by the 12 links. With the Mahamudra teachings, we are concerned mostly with the ultimate truth, which we develop by examining our mind directly. So then he goes, sorry, I left that out because it is very helpful. And then he goes on to explain why it's also important to understand the conventional level of relative reality in the 12 links. All right. So hopefully that's clearer to everybody now. Anybody else? All right, then. So where we go from here is I've talked to Marilyn about maybe doing one. We had talked about possibly doing a session on the Heart Sutra because it's like, it's like takes this to the next level. How do people feel about that? Like just one session on the Heart Sutra too, because this, what we just learned, the whole 12 links thing is part of the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is where the Buddha, that's his first teachings, his first set of teachings where he explains how relative reality works. He parses all of relative reality so that we can see how that works. And then in the second wheel of turning of the wheel, the second set of Dharma teachers, he demolishes it all as being empty. It's all emptiness. It's not literally true in the way, or it's not exclusively true in the way he explained it before. It doesn't invalidate the first turning, but it takes it much deeper. And that's what the Heart Sutra represents, that whole thing. And it's very short. So unless anybody objects, we will do one session next time on the Heart Sutra. We'll be meeting again the last two Sundays of March. Yeah, that's fine with me. Last two Sundays of March is when we will be meeting again. And we will look at the Heart Sutra at that first meeting. And then if we need a second session on the Heart Sutra, then we can do that. But otherwise, we now go on to the Great Path of Awakening, 7 points of mind training.
Which text will you tell the Sangha if they want to do it for the Heart Sutra?
For the Heart Sutra, I will send out, I'm just going to send out a translation of the Heart Sutra. And if you want to have, if you want something to read on the Heart Sutra, thank you for asking, Marilyn. Bokar Rinpoche has a very nice one of his little, thin, easy to read books. It is called The Something Wisdom of the Heart Sutra. I'll send that out. I'll send you a translation of the Heart Sutra, and I will send you a link to Bokar Rinpoche's book. But just look up, just Google Bokar Rinpoche Heart Sutra, and you'll get the Amazon link or the, you know, the link to the book, Lama Jinzang.
So just looking at my March calendar, there are 5 Sundays in March. Mm-hmm. You repeat, we'll do the very last two, the 24th. And the 31st
one I have on my calendar, usually we express it as the 3rd and 4th because most months only have 4. I think looking at my calendar, the last two worked the best for me. So if that's okay with everybody, that would be the 24th and the 31st. Thank you, Lama Jinzang. We really appreciate your scheduling organization. We do. I fall down on that sometimes. And then it comes out piecemeal. All right. So we'll reconvene on March 24th, same time, same cyberspace, and look at the Heart Sutra, which is fun. It's fun to demolish the whole thing, like, and to understand that it's still valid at the same time. I think this will help us all appreciate the Heart Sutra, which is a very wonderful thing that the Buddha expressed, and it's a wonderful thing to chant. All right, we will do our prayers.
Dedication.
Yeah, this one. Okay, so now we'll dedicate all the merit of this session and of our whole study of the 12 links of interdependent origination to the enlightenment of ourselves and all sentient beings. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And just letting our minds come to rest one more time. Okay, everybody's unmuted. Does everybody feel pretty much at peace with the 12 links? Like, I feel like we accomplished our purpose here of understanding them better.
Yes,
better. Fully maybe down the road. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everybody who came to Katie.
Thank you.
And everybody who joined us on Zoom, and I'll see you next time.
Tell them we're sorry they can't meet with us.
Oh, yeah, we're sorry you can't join us for the potluck. We had a splendid potluck the last time I was here, which included pie and ice cream. on the menu today. The pie is on the menu today.
Can I share something? One of the funniest things I saw when my mom was still alive, and I was down in Florida with my parents, and there was a comic thing on HBO or something, and the whole thing was like, who determines what a portion size is? And like, he's like a Fig Newton, like it's like two Fig Newtons. He's like, obviously it's the end of that whole, oops, sorry. Obviously, can you hear me still?
Yes.
It's like, obviously, it's the end of that line in the package. And like, what's the end of a pint? What's ice cream? Obviously, it's when your spoon is hitting the bottom of the pint. Anyway, I got to go now, but thank you all.
Bye-bye. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See you all soon.